Hello everyone and welcome to the Constructive Criticism Network. This network is here to help you improve at Magic the Gathering at every level. From Pauper Leagues to Top 1000 Mythic, we've got you covered. If you want to hear the entire network, head on over to our sponsor at PureMTGO.com, where you can hear each and every show, each and every week, and check out their sponsor, MTGO Traders, and tell them that the CCMTG Network sent you. Now sit back, enjoy the show. From YouTube, podcasts, and more, here's this week's episode from ConstructiveCriticism.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 315th episode of Constructed Criticism. I'm your host, Mason, and back from Arizona, we have Matt Kling. Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
Nice. How was your trip? Because you took a little family vacay in Arizona, right?
Yeah, the trip overall was pretty good. Mm-hmm. The players tour did not go very well for me. I was sick, among other things. I had a 9-hour flight delay. I was supposed to fly in the night before, but ended up having to fly in that morning.
Yeah, that's a yikes. And you had to fly in not because of weather or anything, but because a bird hit your plane, right?
Yeah, it wasn't while I was in it or anything. The plane that we were about to board or whatever, I guess suffered a bird strike is what they said, verbatim. And it had to be taken out of commission for the night to be checked for safety, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure it's like a serious thing, whatever, but the name bird strike, I can only imagine that over the intercom and not chuckling a little bit.
You know? Sure, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess when there's no end there. I guess if I had heard that in the news, it wouldn't be a chuckle moment. But
it was funny because they told us originally that it would only be an extra 5 minutes or whatever. They're like, it's not even showing delayed or whatever. We're just going to get a different plane. It's going to be fine. And then they were like, okay, so some of you might have noticed that your boarding passes have changed to 9-hour delay. Oh my God.
Yikes. All right. Well, you know who won't have a 9-hour delay? That's our sponsor at Oasis Games. You can go to Oasis Games and use code CCMTG to get 4% off every order. And would that be good to get 15% off your first order? Love Oasis Games. Glad to have them. And same for Pure MTGO. Kling, are you ready for our Always Improving moment? Because we're kind of wanting to get to this main topic. It's pretty exciting. But I can't let you skip Always Improving.
I just want to question whether you and Spencer are just great at doing the segues, or if I'm just the greatest alley-ooper in the game. I just have all the setups.
If you have to ask, you know what I mean? I think maybe on some subconscious level you do, but for me, it's kind of I just get the reads on when to go in, you know?
Okay.
And so I don't know how Spencer does it. I don't know if y'all had a script or whatever, but for me, it's like a soul read type moment.
So. I mean, maybe I just do a lot of complaining, so it's easy to say you won't have these complaints if you shop at Oasis, because you won't.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like you could fix all of this. I guess you would create new problems by reducing your problems. You know what I mean?
Exactly. If I had less problems in my life, we would have worse segues.
Exactly. You wouldn't get worse deals from Oasis Games because they had that quality content all the time. But you see what I mean? It's kind of it's a feel thing. It's a lot of it's spin too. You know, you kind of know how to spin things. You don't sell car wax for the first job of your life and not learn how to spin a little. You know what I mean?
Nice.
Yeah. That's if you want to hear that story, go listen to Even Odds episode 22, I think. So there you go. All right. But what was your Always Improving moment this week? How'd you improve?
I didn't do a lot to improve at Magic this week, to be honest. I mostly just enjoyed my vacation. So.
Awesome. All right. I like the honesty. Didn't come up with anything on the fly there. I respect that. Well, for me, kind of talk about last week when we had Drake on the show, how I took that week off, kind of like how you did as well. But this week, I tried really hard to dive into Pioneer and kind of figure out how I want my deck to look in my post-board matchups as Inverter. Because I'm kind of the opinion, Kling, that Inverter game one isn't full throttle combo, but you play it more like a combo deck a lot of the time, so you just try to invert them. And then post board you kind of become like a controlling deck that has a combo more often. Not that the game ones don't play out that way. I just find that it's much easier, obviously, right? It's much easier to combo when your opponent has normally less interaction, unless you're playing the mirrors. And so then post board they kind of bring in this interaction that normally slows you down a bit, so I slow my deck down and try to counteract what their main deck plan is. So, for an example, might be, if you're playing against Green Stompy, I'm bringing in, these Aether Gusts, these Noxious Grasps, these Cast Downs, and then they bring in, maybe a Tormod Script or something like that that kind of forces me to combo in one turn. So.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's pretty obvious that, the games are going to slow down post-board. Like you said, your opponent's going to have more ways to interact with you, and you're kind of forced to interact with your opponent more.
Exactly. Game, so. And so I've been just trying to figure out how I want my how I want my plans to look versus the main decks. And one of the interesting things from all this, like in the proving thing, is just kind of noticing how wide Pioneer is, despite it being a relatively small Eternal format. There's still like a lot of decks, and even though there's a very clear defined top of the mountain we're going to talk about, that doesn't mean you're not going to run into that kind of stuff, especially at the open, especially day one. And so trying to figure out where I can have cards that overlap a lot has been really nice to try and really, you know, condense my sideboard down to like the cards I want, and then not having too much of it. And luckily, one of the cool things about Inverter is like your deck, you see a lot of cards thanks to Dig Through Time, Opt, and Narset, and things like that. And so you're able to play like, all right, against Mono Green, my plan is like these three cards and maybe a Kalidus, right? So just that kind of stuff, figuring out how I want to do that has been good. And it's also like a nice, you know, practicing thing for, you know, when you build your deck, you kind of want to build it as a 75, right? Because you're going to play more post-board matches than you are main deck matches. And so, or I should have main deck games, not matches. Unless you're at the world, you know, but.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. But either way, it was just, it was good to get back and think about things in that light. Because I don't, recently there haven't been a lot of decks that I've had to really focus in on that. That's something that I always try to do. But I think for Inverter, it's critical to have a optimal plan and those kind of things. Whereas other decks like Titan, you kind of want to hedge against what they're doing all the time. And so it's just a different way of thinking about things.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely superior to build your deck as a 75, no matter what you're playing. It's just about how much it makes a difference, right? Like, if you're playing, I mean, not to say that Inverter isn't a combo deck, but it's not exactly a combo deck.
Yeah, it's a weird in between.
So it's more important to have a cohesive sideboard with the main deck. Whereas, like, if you're playing just a straight combo deck, like, often you're just shaving on things. So it's not like... It's not like you have to go into it and say, okay, these cards are bad in this matchup, because you're playing an engine deck oftentimes, right? So, like, there's no cards that are bad. They're just, these are the worst parts of my engine, and I can afford to put sideboard cards in over these. Whereas, like, with Inverter, sometimes you're like, okay, these cards are actively bad in this matchup, so let's bring these in instead. Like, you know, you could easily play a matchup where Fatal Push just doesn't have targets.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and you want to be cognitive of, like, that you have enough cards to bring in, and also that you're not overboarding as well. And definitely. It's just a thing where, like, normally I play a lot of decks where my game plan is more straightforward, even though Inverter kind of, you know, like there's that plan, like I said, you kind of play those weird games a lot of the times with those mid-rangey ones. And something with Titan, you're kind of like, all right, I'm gonna bring in like the Manglehorn, the Veil of Summer, and like, you know, this member as a way to counteract what you're doing in a different way, even though both plans kind of do the same thing. It's a different approach to it, so just trying to, you know, work on that stuff. But that kind of segues us into our training grounds. We're back 2 weeks later from when we last talked about Pioneer, and we've had the American Pioneer tournament, which had a pretty much different top eight for the most part. You know, some overlap, but like a whole new deck kind of took over in that week time period. And then the 2 weeks since then, you know, it's been a big part of the scene, and the metagame's really condensed down to a couple of decks. And so we just kind of want to talk about that. We wanted to also talk about some of the results since then, but I wasn't able to find the deck list from this past weekend's PTQ. All I was able to find is Dylan Donegan won with Inverter, and we've seen that kind of do well on things like the NRG circuit as well. But the PTQ...
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking over some MTGO results from this past weekend as well. They had a premiere event. I'm not sure exactly what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had the challenge. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing the premiere event is probably a PTQ finals of some kind. Based on the number of rounds.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks like Demir Inverter is really putting up the best results.
Yeah.
Online, at least.
Yeah, it seems to be kind of become the de facto best deck. And we'll get into that in a second. But I did want to kind of review the top eight of the PT America, since we hadn't talked about that on the cast yet. Like, we didn't even mention it last week. So the America PT had two Demir, two Lotus Breach, Mono Red Aggro, Soul Tide Delirium, Banned Spirits, and Blue White Control. And then that same weekend, Ben White's won the GP playing Eldrazi Red, which was funny because it was kind of like a more measured approach of the red deck we spent a little bit of time talking on the podcast. I was like, well, why would we do this? Turns out, you know, well, I guess if you want to win the GP, that's a plan. But so that happened. And then we definitely don't want to, you know, like bury the lead or anything here. But Inverter has kind of become the de facto deck, right? Like, it's the deck that seems to be putting up the best stuff, and most people agree seems to be the best deck. Kling, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree based on the results that Demir Inverter just seems like the best deck. It's certainly a powerful strategy. And what's good about it is it's actually really hard to attack. Like, there's no clear cards that you can just sideboard and be like, oh, well, you know, I got the Demir Inverter matchup covered.
Yeah, definitely. It was an interesting thing where today on Twitter, I posted a poll that was like, what is the best deck in Pioneer? And the options were Sultai, midrange, Inverter, Breach Combo, or other, like a write-in. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to see how some people felt that there's like a weird... So some people definitely understood that Breach is the thing that folds heavily to cards like Unmoored Ego, Dampening Sphere, etc. And that was its biggest weakness. But some people were citing that like they felt Inverter lost to those same type of cards, and that was a downside to it. And so it's very interesting to see how there's a bit of a divide in some people on how they're viewing the matchups. Even though I agree with you, I don't think there's any card that Inverter really folds to. Like, the card that is the strongest singular card is probably Gideon of the Trials, but we've, like, adapted to that card. And, like, now we're playing things like Hero's Downfall in the main and the sideboard. So,
sure. I mean, it's even possible you could play, like, even more specific cards, right? Like Gideon's Intervention or something like that, right? Like, a card that blue-black is really unlikely to have an answer to.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Just, like, name Inverter of Truth.
Yeah, so there might be things that are even more narrow, but maybe they're just too unreasonable to play.
Right.
Maybe they just haven't popped up yet. But yeah, it's interesting just because the perception about Pioneer, I think, and this is something I really want to talk about today, so I'm glad we kind of mentioned it here at the start. It's still such a new format that we're still all kind of figuring stuff out, right? And so there's a lot of, you'll see these players who, like, they're very good, but they have, like, very differing opinions from one another because of just, like, we all have such a lack of format knowledge. The format's been changed so much even since its beginning that, like, this is the first time since probably the Invitational that we've had really a set metagame, right? And so it's very interesting.
It's also a pretty open metagame. Like, I'm impressed at how diverse it is, especially after the scare that we had at the PT, right? Like, it definitely looked like Lotus Breach was just going to be this unstoppable monster. But until you saw the people that came more prepared for it, like, it had a much worse day two win percentage than it did on day one. It also had a, you know, not great top eight win percentage. And
that
was pretty clear. Well, yeah, I mean, I realized that one of them made it to the finals. But I think it was pretty clear that the sideboard cards that people were bringing in against Breach were actually effective at some point. Like, once they started playing against things that, you know, like Rest in Peace and things like that aren't actually very good. They're fine, but they're going to be able to get through them eventually. Cards like Damping Sphere and Unmoored Ego are often just like lights out.
Yeah, it's very hard, specifically for Sphere too, because it's like the deck kind of attacks on two angles, right, at times. And then if you don't interact with this, kind of hypers you with both, but like you can use the Breach to like kind of loop your deck, but you can also like Lotus Field to like cheat out a big card, like a Thought Distortion in those matches, or like an Ugin in matches where the board matters. And Damping Sphere stops both of those. And so it's very interesting just how powerful that card is. And then that kind of forces them to adapt by bringing in cards like Unravel the Aether or Natural State. I always get it confused with Nature's Claim, and then it kind of becomes this oddball one. But like it forces them to bring in those cards, which kind of slows them down a lot. And then some of the better decks are Thoughtseize decks, right? Or proactive decks. And so all the decks are really good at capitalizing on that slowdown. So
yeah, definitely. Additionally, I mean, I've just definitely been color screwed by Damping Sphere before because it you know, the Lotus Fields just produce colorless now. And sometimes I found myself in spots where I've Thespian staged the Lotus Field, or I had a draw that was like Lotus Field, sack two lands, play stage or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, if they play a Damping Sphere after you sack the two lands to Lotus Field, sometimes you just won't have any colors of mana.
Yeah, that's so true. And then, yeah, it just becomes so awkward on so many different levels there. And so it's also just something that, like, that they have a really hard time fighting through. Like, it's a card that they can beat given a timeline, right? Like, they can Sylvan Scrying if they have green and, like, go get a Blast Zone and, like, level it up. But
yeah, certainly on a long enough timeline, they'll beat any of the hate just because, like, they have the Fae of Wishes sideboard and, like, you know. Basically, the only one that they are not going to beat on a long enough timeline is Unmoored Ego on the Lotus Field itself. Like, I think that one is pretty much lights out.
Yeah, assuming they don't have a field in play,
I did actually see somebody get clever and side one of the Lotus Fields out.
Yeah, and then you Fae, which is
and then you Fae for it. Yeah, that was definitely cute.
I've heard people say that you name Fae, or you can name Fae in the dark, and that stops a lot of the kills a lot of the time. And you can also name Thespian Stage if they already have a Lotus Field, and then it becomes much harder for them to actually get a bunch of mana because now they have to like set up a new Lotus Field. So there's a lot of interesting things you can do with Unmoored Ego. But yeah, the format. So the kind of like two of the top three decks, you know, in people's mind, the third deck being Sultai, which we'll talk about here in 1 second, are both combo decks that kind of ask for different types of hate. One of the combo decks doesn't even really fold to any of the hate, but like if you want to have pressure against it, it's stuff that isn't super great against field for the most part. Like Damping Sphere doesn't do much against Inverter. Mm-hmm. So it kind of puts this weird pressure on the format. Then we have this weird mid-range deck we're talking about in a second, but then every other deck is a proactive deck. And I think that actually makes for kind of a really fun format, right?
Yeah, I've definitely been enjoying Pioneer.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Sultai, and then we'll kind of get to these other decks that are trying to attack these top decks. What do you feel about the Sultai mid-range deck? Yoel Larson won PT Brussels with it. It's been putting up some pretty good results since then. We've even seen some hybridization at the PT Americas with Inverter and Sultai combining. That seemed to have fallen out of favor now, but what do you think about the Sultai decks?
Yeah, I think Sultai is quite good. I think that with a deck like Sultai, though, it's very important to nail the sideboard for the weekend that you're trying to play.
Mm-hmm.
And additionally, this deck is very difficult.
Yeah, I think that might have been something that we didn't, at least I didn't appreciate enough when we talked about it last time, was just how difficult it is to play in some spots and just how arms racy the mirrors can also be.
Well, so what I think is interesting about the way that people view things that are difficult, a lot of people will say that Lotus Breach is a very difficult deck to play. I don't personally find that to be true, because once you understand the play patterns, they all are very similar. I mean, sometimes you have to come up with creative plays with Fae of Wishes and things like that, and like it is a lot about counting mana and deciding how much mana you can have next turn, and you know, like taking some calculated
risks.
Yeah, not necessarily risks, but like just trying to figure out what the best percentages you have are, right? Like if you're like, okay, I can spend 5 mana on Pour Over the Pages or 2 mana on Hidden Strings, and like what do each of these lead to?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of that kind of stuff, but like when you play Sultai Delirium, the reason it doesn't feel as hard is because when you're making the wrong play, you just don't even know it.
Yeah, it's, like, it's just very like
obtuse. Watching Jacob Wilson play the Players Tour, I did not make, like I was watching him and trying to imagine what I would do from his spot. And I don't think that I took the right line even one time.
Sure. Yeah, it's very challenging. I was just watching Allie in the Discord, and she was playing. And there were definitely a couple spots where I was very confused, but she was able to, you know, navigate the game in such a way by making those plays. And it does require that more foresight. And I think that's one of the things. It's an interesting kind of point to bring up. It happens with Amulet Titan 2, right? Where it's like, oh, this is so hard to do all these things, but it's actually kind of very similar to Breach.
Right.
Where, like, you kind of learn play patterns, and the hard games are hard, but the hard games are going to be hard with every deck in Magic. These are just a different type of hard you're not used to, and once you kind of play those decks for a little bit, it becomes easier. And with these mid-range decks, and also I think aggro decks are a very similar reason, can be hard, and it can be punishing in a way that you don't even notice because it's so obtuse to what you were supposed to do.
Right, exactly. Yeah, people just make the wrong plays with those decks and just don't realize it because, I mean, with mid-range especially, because oftentimes you're going to win the games that you're supposed to win anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if you're making the suboptimal plays. But to win the games that you're not supposed to win really takes some talent.
For sure. Yeah. Well, so that's kind of Sultai. It's a hard deck to talk about, one thing, because there are so many different things you can try. Like, I've seen Eat to Extinction. I've seen Tameo. I've seen Atrus, the Half-Truths, I believe is the card name. There's just a lot of crazy things going on with Sultai, and so it's kind of like this nebulous 120 of cards that kind of switch up, right, depending on the weekend, like you talked about. And so those are kind of the three best decks, right? It's like two Thoughtseize decks and an all-in combo deck, and you could also say two Dig Through Time decks, right? And then everything else that is kind of like a reasonable deck congeals around attacking those in a very proactive way. And so we talked about it before, and you said you're going to play Spirits and you like the deck. How do you feel about Spirits now to start off the conversation of the other decks in Pioneer?
Well, to start off this conversation, I would like to point out that those would not be my top three decks, especially looking at results recently.
What would you say your top three decks are?
Well, I would have to put it to a top four, and I do not think the Lotus Breach is on there. I think that people have already adapted to that deck and understand how to beat it.
Interesting. Okay, I think... Well, here, what do you think? That doesn't matter.
So I think that the best decks are Dimir Inverter at number one, pretty clearly. And then I think that the next three are pretty close. Silt-Tide Delirium is probably number two. Then Bant Spirits and Mono White Heliod.
Interesting. So Heliod has put up some pretty good results, but I find that... So last time on the podcast when we talked Pioneer, I was really low on Heliod, and you got me higher on it, right? Not like out of this world high, but like, you know, you kind of swung me. And since then, I have played against the Heliod deck a lot. And what I have found is that the Heliod deck has a lot of C+ and B- game plans across the board, right? Which can make for a very powerful deck traditionally. But with what's going on right now, it leads me to a deck that I am not super impressed by still.
I think that this is another deck similar to Silt-Tide Delirium where sometimes when you're playing against it, your opponent's making a lot of bad plays. And it's not obvious.
Sure. Like
maybe because they're playing cards that cost the amount of mana that they have.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really important to understand how to pressure your opponent. It's about what's the word I'm looking for? They have a magic theory about this style of deck where you basically attack from so many different angles that you like stranglehold your opponent into a position where they have to try to play around all these different things and then eventually they, you know, let one slide through.
Kind of like Inverter.
It's similar to Inverter, except a lot more on an aggressive angle, right? Like, Inverter's always going to win with the combo, whereas this one is, I mean, at least as often is going to win with just attacking with creatures and valuing your opponent out with 2-for-1s.
Interesting. One of the things I've found about Inverter is that I'm winning a lot more games with just a 6-6 than I thought I would be.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I guess it's not... I shouldn't say always. You're always going to win with Inverter of Truth, I should say that.
Sure, that's fair, yeah. Yeah, at least until post-sport. That makes sense. That's reasonable. Okay, sure. So you don't think so I hear what you're saying, and I don't necessarily disagree completely. I would just say that I think the Breach deck is still inherently powerful and kind of does a very similar role to what Affinity did in Modern in like the 2015 era, where if you don't respect it with the hate or you don't get your hate, the deck can just overpower you, right? So like it wins a lot of game ones.
So yeah. I definitely think that going forward, if nothing changes in Pioneer through, you know, ban list or like something insane getting printed or whatever, I definitely think that there's going to be a weekend and possibly not even in the distant future where Lotus Breach is just going to be the insane best deck. You know, it's like Dredge in Legacy, you know, people forget about it sometimes and then like
it just dominates
a tournament. And I'm sure that Breach is basically in that same position right now. Like it's without the hate, I think that it's the most powerful deck in the format. I just think that the sideboards right now are built with Breach in mind. Yes.
Yeah. I think that too. But so in my mind, it's like a third best deck. I still just think that its default draw is better than the Spirits and Heliod, but not. I would say not like crazy amount. We're kind of splitting hairs at a certain point. It doesn't really matter. Like I think those decks are still quite good, but I just think that the format also is so proactive because of its presence. Like I feel like you said, once that deck dies down because everyone's so aggro on it at the moment between sideboards and the way the metagame's played out. Now we're like you can. I honestly believe the only decks that are playable are aggressive decks, Inverter. Being the Breach Mirror, we're having the Silt-Tide deck. I don't think other decks are able to like reasonably handle that kind of deck. And when everything's like that, it really pushes on the format in that way. And it puts this pressure point of like, you have to be doing your thing quickly, or the proactive decks are going to make you, they're going to like capitalize on your stumbles and they're going to aggro you out. And so like Spirits does that in a way of like disrupting your draw a little bit. Mono Red does that in pure aggression. Thoughtseize does it by disrupting with this. I'm sorry. Mono Black does it by using Thoughtseize to disrupt your draw or like a wrinkle or something like that. And so that's kind of where I am on it, where it's like I think the deck is kind of a symptom of the format right now with it having the spotlight on it kind of, you know? Like the narrative is so much around Breach.
I think that the format having combo decks like Dimir Inverter and Lotus Breach has like basically set what turn the format is.
Yeah,
like having good tier one combo decks like that determines what turn every deck has to be able to win by, or that's the turn they have to have in mind at the very least, right? That's the turn where you have to make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And We see that a lot with like a lot of the aggressive decks popping up. I mean, Sultai Delirium is able to compete because it has so much disruption and like
a good enough ish clock.
Enough value, yeah. But that does stop the arms race that we're talking about from like the Sultai Delirium mirrors, right? Like you're never gonna really see the Sultai Delirium decks go super over the top because they have to be concerned with all these turn five decks.
Mm-hmm. At least not successfully go over the top.
Sure.
Yeah. That's all. I mean, I'm sure some people will do it. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. Worldbreaker rocked my world, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I definitely agree. So what do you feel? Cause it's definitely like a interesting talk to have, because I think that a lot of times we don't bring that up enough, but what do you think about mono black? You know, cause I think the talk we just had is very important to frame what we're going to talk about in a second. But what do you think about the other decks? We should just kind of talk about those for a minute.
Sure. Yeah. So I don't think that mono black is necessarily a bad deck. It hasn't gotten worse, but the other decks around it have gotten better. So I think it's pretty solidly in tier two right now. You can certainly win. Like it has draws that are very good, between, you know, aggression and the right mix of discard. The problem is that as the other decks around it get better, you need a very specific combination of disruption and pressure now.
Okay. So do you feel that because of that, like it's still high up there in your mind is like, for example, if your friend was like, I'm going to play mono black at a GP, right? Would you like try to talk them out of it? If they asked your opinion, where you'd be like, yeah, that's reasonable. Like where are you at?
I would probably try to talk them out of it only because I think that there are probably like five other decks that I think that are better than that. And sure. I just don't see what the appeal of playing a deck that's, you know, that far down the pecking order, but
yeah, I'm with you. I think that, you know, unless they're just going to have like a great time, and I know they love the mono black strategies, I'm going to try and suggest a different deck. And I think part of that is because the deck also, even though all its draws are very similar, because there's a lot of very similar cards, those cards are not impressive. And when natural things happen, like you have to mulligan, etc., the deck kind of stumbles because of that. Right.
Right. Like, or you draw like one too many lands that aren't Castle Lockthwain. Like
exactly. Yeah. And even though the deck like it does, it's like one of the best aggro decks at going long. The format's not really about that being a positive feature. Right. Like when we were seeing mono black before, there were decks that could go long and you were like, okay, this is like a fine feature, or it was just a bunch of mirrors and you wanted to have that. With that not being a real focal point of the format, that's not a huge draw to the deck anymore. And so.
Yeah, I agree. The resilience isn't impressive anymore because a lot of the, like, you have to be the aggro control deck in a lot of matchups. Like it's specifically your job to either kill your opponent or stop them from comboing off. Whereas before, a lot of it was your opponent trying to stop you from killing them. So like a lot of your scrap heap scrounger draws and your, you know, gutter bones and like blood soaked champions were really impressive. Mm-hmm. But now it's just too important to have like one drop Thoughtseize, two drop or whatever, you know, like,
yeah, you kind
of, those draws are still going to get you there against the combo decks most of the time,
but yeah, you really have to have those draws.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's definitely a deck too, that I think it also punishes small mistakes. Kind of like what we talked about with Sultai in a way, because of the lack of power level in the cards. Right. And so when you have these bunch of 2/1s for one, you know, a bunch of Savannah Lions, they can't carry you in spots where, like, you know, you make a small mistake, where other cards like having Dig Through Time and Jace Wheel of Mysteries and drawing like four extra cards a turn, right? Like that's going to get you through spots. Like you can figure a way out to win from there.
Yeah, it's also important to realize that while they both have card advantage, Mono Black's card advantage only works when your opponent's interacting.
Yeah, that's a good point to bring up.
Like Sultai Delirium can actually draw cards via, you know, Uro or
Tiles Tracker.
Yeah, Jace Friend's Prodigies is Cameo. Pretty much drawing cards. Yeah. So and like Traverse the Elvenwald as a tutor. So they have ways to actually find things out of their deck. Whereas Mono Black, you are up a card if your opponent decides that they have to use a removal spell on Bloodsoak Champion, but that's not what the format's about right now. So you're never getting that simulated card advantage through Mono Black right now.
Yeah, I agree with that. So let's talk about Mono Red. This was a deck that I was pretty interested in. We kind of talked about it last time on the show. Ultimate up was like, why would we go there? It's had some results. What do you think about Mono Red?
I think it's in a pretty similar spot to Mono Black. I don't think that there's a lot of appeal to play this deck. It doesn't mean that it's like, you know, could never win a tournament. But I think that even on the GP weekend when it won, I just think that there's a lot of evidence that it was not the best deck to play and that things worked out well. And Who did you say won the GP with?
It was Ben Whites.
Ben Whites probably played really well.
Yeah, Ben Whites is insane. Did you see he had Satyr's Calling in his deck?
I did not.
Yeah, what's it called? Escape, make a one Satyr token card was in his
deck. Oh, okay, sure, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was just a trigger prowess.
It's Satyr's Cunning.
Satyr's Cunning, my bad. Yeah. Yeah, so you know Ben's really doing it. If Satyr's Cunning can win a GP, you can win a GP.
Well, what's good to note about something like that is that it means that this person has a very clear plan with what they're doing with it, right? Like, it's not like you're like, oh, I think Satyr's Cunning is good in this matchup just randomly. You're like, okay, I need something that serves this exact function. What is the best option? And that's how you come to something like Satyr's Cunning.
For sure, yeah. Repeatable.
So I would say that that's even more evidence to support the theory that the deck wasn't necessarily a good metagame call, but he played it really well and understood a lot of his matchups.
Interesting. See, I would say it was a good metagame call because the way he put the Obligator's main deck and had the Eidolons and stuff like that main deck. Or maybe he just had access to the board. I can't remember exactly the configuration, and I've played the deck a little bit and switched stuff up, so that might be on me now. But basically, he was ready for Breach and Inverter, and people weren't ready for him. And so I think what happened is a lot of people saw the PT results from Breach. They really adapted to having Breach hate, including him, with the four Dampening Spheres in his sideboard. And so then when you have cards like Eidolon, they can't really combo through that card. It takes like kind of a lot, especially if you're putting them on the back foot early. And then against Inverter, a lot of times with Inverter, your game plan is like interact a little bit, stick an Inverter, and then combo them and have that 6/6 be the thing that stops them. And then having cards that could get around that with Satyrs, making the prowess creatures bigger and actually putting more bias on the board is nice. And then also along the same lines, having the Obligator to actually swing is pretty big.
I'm not saying that it can't line up. I'm saying that I don't believe that that's... I mean, you're in a situation where against Inverter, you have to draw the Obligator. It's not like, oh, I have this Obligator in my deck because, you know, it's good against this deck. It's like, okay, well, if they play the 6/6 and are ready to come off the next turn, then I don't draw the Obligator. I'm just going to lose. So that's just a bad matchup.
Sure, I guess there's a different way to look at it. I just thought of it as like a teched out red deck for the weekend. And I thought
I'm certain that it is teched out. But I think we can just look at results right now and then conclude that it's obviously not something that works most of the time, right?
Yeah, like, no, that I was about to say that I don't think it's good now. It was just interesting to me because in my mind, I thought it was a good call for that weekend, but not so far now after having seen how things played out. And you were saying it wasn't. So that maybe that was just a misunderstanding on my part, and that's on me.
I do not think that it was a good metagame call for that weekend still.
Sure. We can have this conversation continue off air, I guess. Or if people want to hear about it, let us know. We'll do a Patreon episode and just talk about it more. But we're not going to get anywhere here talking about that, I think. So that's kind of Pioneer. We talked about Spirits a little bit, right? We talked about all these decks. Is there any deck that you feel... We even mentioned the Heliod deck again. How much you love that deck. The one deck, I guess, and we did this last time too, is that we didn't talk about that had some results, the Blue-White Control. I still feel like that deck is just not it in any way.
I 100% agree. I think that the draws have to really line up for you with Blue-White in this format. I mean, so the thing about Blue-White is that you can curve out sometimes in an insane way that your opponent can never beat. Like, if you're just like, oh, I just have the Mystical Dispute into Dobin's Veto, into like another counterspell, into Dig Through Time, into Teferi or whatever. Most decks are not beating that, but that's just not the way that it works more often than not.
Sure. Yeah.
And you also have to be playing a matchup where that's the draw that you need, right? Like, sometimes you'll be playing the matchup where none of your counterspells really do anything. Like, you're playing against, like, Spirits or something, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I just think that Blue-White Control remains kind of flawed, and the format is pressuring it in a way that it can't reasonably respond to everything that's going on at the top and still respond for the other decks trying to vie for that spot, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I also think that a couple of the decks that I think are the best decks are also terrible matchups for Blue-White. Like, I think Spirits has a quite favorable matchup against Blue-White, and I think that Dimir Inverter also.
Yeah, I also think the Mono-White Heliod deck has a surprisingly good matchup. Not that it has a great matchup or anything, but the fact that, like, it can apply pressure on board and then kind of hold up a turn where it can, like, Heliod combo you.
Mm-hmm.
Is a surprisingly potent thing. It really
does. Yeah, it's threats are also pretty diverse too, right? Like, when you have like a Heliod and like a 2/2 first strike and then a Gideon in play, like, it's pretty hard for them to answer all of that with one card.
Yeah, I agree with that a lot. So that's kind of it when it comes to Pioneer talking about specific decks. And we kind of did some of this already throughout the course of the show, but I do kind of think that it's important to talk about how the pressure on the format really is supposed to inform your deck choice. And this is kind of part two of the training grounds main topic today is, Kling, when you see a format kind of get pressured like this, right, where there's these linear aggressive decks and this combo deck, combo decks, you know, near the top of the metagame, even to Heliod, right, in a similar way, kind of combos in a way you have to interact with. If you want to say that's your third deck, for example, instead of Breach, how do you go about picking a deck? Like, there's a lot of pressure on the format and a lot of different angles. And also, a lot of these decks seem pretty reasonable. Results-wise, Inverter seems to be the clear choice. But sometimes you don't want to play mirrors. You don't want to play the deck that has the target on its back. How do you approach things like now?
I think it really. So I've gone back and forth on this a bunch of times over my Magic career, and I think that at this point, I do believe that it really depends on what tournament you're playing. I think that a lot of the best players on the SCG circuit have proved that metagaming against the best deck is actually a really viable strategy for that circuit. Mm-hmm. I do not believe that that's a viable strategy at all for like a Grand Prix or Magic Fest or anything like that. I think that at that level of at the Grand Prix level or Magic Fest or whatever they're calling it these days, sure. That there are enough people that are just bringing the deck that they have or the deck that they like or a deck that they think that has a good matchup in a place where it doesn't, that it just doesn't make sense. But I think that at the SCG level, often there are going to be enough people that are like grinders that are going to be playing the best deck that it makes sense to metagame mm-hmm. in that capacity.
Yeah. I think that is a very good take. I am in an interesting point where I think it also matters the kind of the results and what you want from that weekend, right? We actually kind of just had this call, this conversation in the Discord call I was in, where it's like, okay, are you trying to like spike the tournament or are you trying to rack up like 10 points of the PC race? Like what's the goal, right?
And so I used to think this way a lot, and I actually think that this is flawed thinking.
Okay.
And it's probably not because of the reason that you think it is. I think that you can play the Hail Mary deck and that's fine. But I actually think that you have a lot better chance of spiking a tournament with just like a solid deck that you're expecting to X5 with than I thought before. Like it's not like you're like, oh, I'm gonna play Amulet this week, it's guaranteed X5 or whatever. Sometimes you're just gonna win with Amulet.
No, for sure. It's interesting. That wasn't the point I was gonna make with that. So that's okay. We've had that conversation before though, and I definitely heard that train of thought. I don't think that's uncommon. It was more that specifically to the metagaming point that you brought up, where it's like, do you want to like make sure your deck is teched out and kind of do that kind of thing? Where, like you said, like it's been kind of shown on the SG circuit that you can have these more teched out decks. You can kind of target the metagames more. And because people kind of gravitate towards playing the best decks a large percentage of the time, those kind of reads can really pay off, right? And those kind of adaptations can really pay off. So, like, a random example might be, let's say you believe Narset, Parted Veils is insanely well positioned this weekend for whatever reason, right? You could play extra Narsets, and that's a way to gain an edge. Or if you feel you don't want to over metagame and hurt your deck in those other matchups, then you might want to play a more stock version of the deck.
Sure. Yeah, the thing you're saying actually makes more sense. Like, basically you're saying that if you feel that...
I was going to say you should play the best deck.
The line of thought here, at least, is that if you feel that you need to top 8, then it's possible to playing a deck that's more metagamed would make sense, because once you get up to the top tables, you'll have a lot more good matchups.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. Whereas, like, just playing the... but, like, at the same time, if you're playing, like, a way more metagamed deck, then you might suffer early and just have, like, an 0-2 drop or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. And that's part of the reason why having buys is so important. You know? Right. Yeah, when we were having that conversation, I was like, all right, well, Dylan has 2 buys. So, like, you will skip a lot of the Galta decks if you do that, you know? Like,
right.
Things like that. But I kind of believe, and Huey kind of said this in his top 8, or maybe it was his going into the finals interview. It was one of those things where they kind of asked him about, like, what do you think about deck selection and everything like that? And Huey kind of said, I think if you think you're one of the best players you've been proven to be, you should just take the time to learn the best deck and play it, right? It doesn't really matter if you're, like, a mono-white player or I'm a combo player or I'm a control player. You should just play whatever deck you think is best. And then from that point, I do think the next question is, okay, once you accept that philosophy and make that your mantra or whatever, it's okay, do I need to be pinpointing for a metagame this weekend, or do I just need to play the most broad deck possible? The broad configuration of the deck, if that makes sense.
Right, yeah.
And so
the stock list for, you know.
Exactly.
Lack of a better way to say it.
Exactly. So for me, it's kind of, I'm going to, I think basically my approach to this is playing the best deck. Because goal does matter a lot, right? Like, also, if your goal is to have fun or whatever, then disregard this conversation. But I should say your only goal is that. Because, you know, we have fun playing these Magic tournaments and doing this kind of stuff is really fun for us. But that all being said, I think just playing the best deck, as long as you know it's still the best deck. So an example of this might be, if you were at the GP on Friday, right? Or, I'm sorry, on Saturday for Phoenix, the narrative kind of going into that was Breach is the best deck, right? But if you believe from other reasons that, like, Inverter with extra stuff for Breach, like this 2-3 Dampening Spheres turns out is all it takes, is the best deck, then just do that and skew it, right? Like, you don't need to completely jump ship if you have great reasons to believe your deck is actually the best deck. Similar logic, if you think there's another deck popping up that can actually attack this one, and it's also very good, like Inverter was in that situation, I think it's totally reasonable to hop ship to that deck. So,
yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's the advice I give most often to people that are asking me how they can improve at Magic. I mean, 99.9% of the time, I mean, maybe even more than that, it's just correct to play the best deck.
Yeah.
And honestly, until enough people get on board with that plan, it's just going to be... you're just getting free percentage by playing the best deck.
I agree. I think if you like take this on like a long enough timeline, like the 20XX theory in Melee, like on a long enough timeline, if everyone eventually adopts, right, the idea that you should just play the best deck no matter what, then and only then can we start having the conversation of should I be playing this weird deck to be attacking these decks, right?
Sure. Well, that's, but that theory breaks down,
like,
though.
It breaks down. I'm just saying, but like right now, I think you are doing yourself... Yeah, let me lead in. I'm trying to like set up a thing. Okay. You're doing yourself a disservice to play one of those decks. That's like, I'm going to play the Galta deck or whatever, because the Galta deck destroys the, you know, Inverter deck or whatnot, right? And Inverter deck's like so much of the field is just going to crush. And in reality, even having all these conversations, you know, the Inverter deck's like, I think in Breach was like 18% of the day one metagame at the PT, Inverter was like 15 or something, like maybe that's reversed, but like, you know, they only made up like 30% of the metagame, right? So there's still so many other decks, there's so many things, and then there's a reason these are the best decks, right? And so I think it's very easy when you see this kind of metagame to trick yourself into playing something kind of wild, right? And that's what we were talking about before in the call. It's like, okay, what do we do here? And it's like, the answer is just play the best deck. It's just that simple. And so I kind of thought that was a important thing to talk about today.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that the thing that I was saying was flawed was that in the 20XX when everybody's adopted this theory, because the problem is that we're all human beings, right? And like people have different goals for one, right? Like not everybody is interested in playing the best deck, even if they think that it gives them the best chance to win.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, there are a bunch of biases, and like there are... like you said, it's easy to trick yourself into believing that something else is correct.
Yeah, and I think that it's awkward, because I think a lot of the times, like, for example, I think you and I are in an agreement that Inverter is the best deck. I think a lot of people agree with that, right? I don't know how much more percent Sultai, or how much more percent Inverter is better than Sultai, and Magic has enough variance where things sometimes don't play out that way, right? And so... and just also, like, your tournament breaks differently. Like, I can't tell you how many times, like, my experience in SCG has just been totally different than other people's, right? And I've played, like, all the rounds or whatever, right? They're just like, oh, my God. I played against so much Arclight Phoenix this weekend. Next weekend, I'm going to have extra hate. And it's like, I've played against one Arclight Phoenix across the last two Opens. Like, right. I played 30 rounds. I played against one Phoenix deck. Come on. Same thing happened with Hogak. Just... your experiences can be so varied, and it can be hard to figure this stuff out. But I think once you kind of get this, I can't remember, there's a phrase in yoga. I want to say it's your dharma, but I might be wrong there. But either way, it's like this guiding light or whatnot, right? And like, if you just make your guiding light to play the best deck and you're just kind of always default to that, I think it's going to serve you way better.
And I honestly think that if you won't even have to do it that long to see the results and just never go back. Like, I feel like I was not a play the best deck person for a long time, and it really cost me a lot. I think that
if I had started JP playing the deck,
yeah, I mean, well, to be fair, I had good reason to play a deck that wasn't the best deck at that one.
Sure, no, I was just joking. Keep going. Sorry, yeah. Bad joke. Takes away from your point.
Yeah. So anyway. but yeah, I think, I mean, like, I didn't day two my first, like, 15 GPs or whatever, because I just always play a bunch of cute nonsense. And then eventually I figured out that if I was just playing good decks all the time, I would, you know, you basically get, like, 15% for free in every match. Like, every time you sit down across from your opponent and they're not playing the best deck, you're just, like, up 10% or whatever.
Yeah, especially, too, if, like, one thing that I think happens, and we spent a lot more time talking about this than I thought we would, but I think it's good, for what it's worth. But I think what happens is sometimes flawed concepts happen, right? And it can happen to anyone. We saw it happen kind of with the blue-green Karn deck on Team Channel Fireball, right? Like, they had this maybe flawed conclusion about what the metagame was about and stuff and what matchups were about, and then the deck just didn't really pan out, right? And that can happen, too, when you sit down, and let's say someone, like we said before, they think their Galta deck just has this great inverter matchup, right? Because they played against it some with their friend, or they played against, like, a, you know, a couple games in Arena or whatever, and they were just like, oh, yeah, I just, like, curve out on them, and the Galta, you just, it's too much with the haste with the Regisaur, and they just die. It's just, I'm the turn four deck, right? And then you, like, play, and your opponents are the tournament, so they don't keep, like, an unreasonable hand like maybe they did on Arena, right? And they, like, censor your three drop, and then they fatal push your two drop on, like, that same turn, and then, you know, they dig through time, they inverter and pass, and they're at, like, 15, and you have no power, right? Just, you get these, like, flawed concepts of what the matchup's about, then you go to sideboard, right? And you, like, had this flawed concept because your practice wasn't right. And you have all these, like, misconceptions. And I think that kind of stuff actually happens a lot, too. And one of the best things about playing the best deck is, a lot of times there are a lot of people working on that deck, and you're able to get extra ideas. And you get these sideboard guides from, you know, these top players. And so...
Yeah, definitely. You get to understand what conclusions other people have come to. That's really nice.
Yeah. Yeah, having extra minds work on a deck makes the conclusions happen so much faster, right? I'm sure you all have played a brew, and then you're like, you had your friend help you out with your brew, and they came up with this really great idea. Now imagine that times, like, 10,000, right?
Right.
And that's kind of what happens with these top decks. So, Kling, I think this can wrap us up on Pioneer. My last question I had was where we're at with Pioneer. I think we're both on Inverter, given what we just said, right?
Yeah. I think that given that we're both saying that Inverter is the best deck, and we're also both saying that you should basically always play the best deck.
We're both going to play White-Black.
It would be pretty hypocritical to be like, oh, yeah, I'm on Mono-White Helion.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm playing White-Black Inverters. You know, show us life. Or whatever.
That being said, yeah. As far as, like, my overall format takes, I actually think that there are a lot of really good decks, and they're pretty close to each other. So I think that if you're playing Dimir Inverter, Lotus Breach, Soul Tide Delirium, Spirits, that was another one I was forgetting.
Mono Red, Heliod combo.
Like Heliod combo, yeah. I think any of those five decks is actually totally fine, and it's honestly going to come down to a lot of player preference unless you really are fiending for percentage points.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I don't think I could fault anyone for picking any of those decks you just said. Excuse me, sorry. But, like, you know, that's what it talks about.
If your goal is to win the tournament, play Dimir Inverter. But I don't think that you are hurting yourself a lot by playing any of these other decks.
Yeah, exactly right. It's just, like, how much do you want to scrap for that extra percent or whatever.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think that wraps us up there. Also, before we leave, I just want to say rest in peace, Niv-Mizzet. It was a sweet 2 weeks. That was the, you know, the best of days and the worst of days with the Niv-Mizzet mirrors and the Chonky Red time. Whew. What a time to be alive. Well, if you want to follow Kling and talk to him about how much you love Super Smash Bros. Melee Ultimate, either one, you can go to @TheWitchKling on Twitter. And is there anywhere else I can find you, Kling?
I mean, you can find me on Facebook, my first and last name.
That's fair.
But yeah, pretty much Twitter is one of the better ways to get a hold of me.
Awesome. You can find me @MasonEClark on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook as well in the Constructed Critics group. And you can find me at twitch.tv/TheMasonClark. And this show is brought to you by listeners like you, our sponsor at Oasis Game, our sponsor at Pure MTGO, and, like I mentioned, the listeners, patreon.com. If you enjoyed this show and you want to give a little bit back, you go to patreon.com/ccmtg. Support the show. It means a lot. If you can never support, that's fine. No worries. But if you want to give back, we're hoping that we can offer you something as well, whether that's deck lists, extra episodes, Neo Talk 101, being able to ask questions. We're going to soon bring back the Patreon question part of the show. It's just been kind of a thing where a lot going on. Do we want to keep that part of the segment or not? And I think we want to keep that going forward and make that actually a bigger part of the show. And so expect to see that soon. So thank you all so much for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
See ya.